All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's begin now. Let's start. We have a lesson that is so filled with insight. It's good stuff. It's very good stuff. Folks, you're in for a treat tonight. Let's begin with a story. Story is, it's not a very happy story, but the story goes that the rabbi of the synagogue had taken ill. He had a bad case of the flu. And so I don't know why I'm smiling. Okay, it's a joke. So the president of the synagogue shows up at the rabbi's house, and he says, I'm here with good news and bad news. Rabbi's lying in bed. He's tell me the good news. He says, here's the good news. On behalf of the board, I'd like to wish you a speedy recovery. He says, so what's the bad news? The bad news is the vote was 5-4. Tough crowd. Okay.
Sounds like what a rap on the
road. It's pretty close. It's good it wasn't 4-5.
Because
could have gone with 9, right? That would be very impressive. All right. For the half guy was a little unsure. So last week, what we did was we explored the debate, the great debate between Rabbi Yehoshua and the 60 elders of Athens. What we discovered in the process were some amazing lessons regarding the value of human life and the Jewish perspective on pain and suffering, difficult moments. We said that Judaism looks at life as having infinite value, essential value. And Judaism also looks at the painful moments as moments, experiences that are also coming from God. But that's all last week. So this week, we return back from Athens. We're no longer in Greece. We're back in Israel now. And we focus on a debate that takes place within the halls of the great Talmudic Academy in Israel, in the city of Yavne, which I'll explain the history behind in a moment. A debate that occurs in the walls of the academy between two of the greatest sages of that era, namely Rabbi Yehoshua, the same Rabbi Yehoshua that we spoke about last week who debated the Greeks, and Rabbi Eliezer. Two colleagues that had a major dispute regarding none other than an oven. They were discussing fiercely an oven. As we'll soon see, this Talmudic debate quickly turns supernatural. Miracles are performed to sway the final decision, but ultimately to no avail. So what we're going to do is, we're going to be laying out the story. We'll be presenting the story as it's recorded in the Talmud. Again, this fierce debate inside the halls of the Talmudic Academy between Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer, we'll be laying it out. Then the next step, what we're going to do is we're going to pull it apart. We're going to shred the story apart and pepper it with questions. And then finally, step three is we're going to reconstruct the story, putting it back together in a way that should amaze you. Not only will you have a clear understanding of this enigmatic Talmudic debate, good evening, Keshev Sam Nachas. Not only are we going to shed amazing light on this enigmatic debate, but what we're also going to do in the process is draw some relevant, practical, personal life lessons from this debate, from the story of this debate. Plus, point three is we're going to gain insight behind the curtain's look at the process of how the law is arrived at in Judaism. In other words, how do we arrive at the halakha, at the law, when there is a debate amongst the great sages? How did they come to decide the halakha? We're going to be looking at that process tonight as well. So again, three objectives. Number one is deciphering the story. Number two is deriving life lessons from that story. Number three is taking a behind-the-curtains look at how halakha, Jewish law, is decided. Everyone with me so far? Let's begin. Let me give you some history. First of all, the name of the class. The Great Oven Debacle. In my opinion, they were planning on calling it the Great Oven Debate, but then they realized that lesson four also has debate in the title, so they had mixed it up a little bit. So it's a little bit awkward. It's not a debacle. It's actually a debate. It could be the Great Oven Debate. Clash between idealism and pragmatism. So the debate we're about to study took place in the first century of our common era. A few decades before the debate that we read about last week. Remember last week we read about a debate that happened in Athens in the second century. This is in the first century, and it occurs again in Israel. So here's what was going on then. The Romans, as we know, had destroyed the temple. They conquered Jerusalem, destroyed the temple around the year 70 of our common era, the year 70. Shortly before the temple fell, shortly before Jerusalem fell, there was a great sage, one of the great leaders, Jewish leaders of the time, whose name was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was trying to get out of the city. The Talmud in Tractate Gittin tells us the following. There were the zealots. There were a group of Jews who were called the zealots, who were inside the walls. The Romans were besieging the city. They surrounded the city. But there was a group of Jews inside the walls of Jerusalem, known as the zealots. Why were they zealots? Because they were very zealous. What were they zealous about? Fighting the Romans and gaining back their nationalistic autonomy. In other words, we will fight the Romans to the end. It's not, we don't want to be, remember I said last week that Judea became part annexed, part of the Roman Empire. It's unacceptable. That's not good. We're going to fight to the end. Well, they fought all right, and they lost. But here's what happened. The zealots wanted everyone to fight. In fact, the Talmud tells us that there were three wealthy men in Jerusalem that had enough food stored in their storehouses that they could have lasted, sat out, endured a siege of many, many years because they had so much food in the city. What did the zealots do?
Burned it
all down. Why? Because now you have to fight. Otherwise, everyone would have been fine, sitting it out. The zealots went ahead and burned out all of the food in Jerusalem. So they had enough, they couldn't but fight. They had to fight. The zealots did this. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wants to leave, wants to escape Jerusalem. He can't. There's no way to get out. The zealots are not letting anyone out of the city. What does he do? Classic. Fakes his own death. The Talmud says, he fakes his own death, he has disciples, put him in a coffin, and two disciples are carrying his coffin out. Which two? Rabbi Yehoshua from last week, Rabbi Eliezer, who we're going to be introduced to this week. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua were the two prime students, the primary students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. They are holding the coffin, they approach the city gates. The zealots are standing there. And the zealots say, what are you doing? We're burying our teacher. He passed away. There's a big funeral. We don't believe you. They're about to take out their swords and stab it through the coffin. Upon which the students, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, say to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, is this, say it in Hebrew, is this, or Yiddish, Hebrew, is this kavadik? Is this, what does that mean? Is this befitting? To do to a tzaddik, a holy person, you take a knife and you stick it through the coffin to defile, to mutilate the body. Not even the Romans. The Romans would look at this funny. So they didn't, and he got smuggled out, and he was alive. What happens is he gets out of this, they get out of the city, he gets out of the coffin, right? And now he heads straight over to the tent of Vespasian. Vespasian was the Roman general. He also, right after their meeting, or during their meeting, became the Roman emperor. Because news came from Rome that the emperor had died, and Vespasian was proclaimed the next emperor. He left the front, and another general replaced him. But at that point, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gained favor in the eyes of Vespasian, also because he called him your majesty, and he said, I'm not your majesty, I'm not emperor. And then a moment later, he was proclaimed emperor. So he said, I see you have, there's something to you. He says, what's your request? And I'll grant it. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, give me Yavne v'chachomel. Give me Yavne, give me the city and the sages. In other words, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saw the handwriting on the wall, i.e., that Jerusalem would fall, the temple would be destroyed. And so he said, already before this happens, we need to put a plan B into place, into action. We need to preserve somehow the integrity of Judaism, and even though the temple will be destroyed, we have to have a safe haven for Judaism to be perpetuated in the form of Torah study, Torah analysis, and mitzvah observance. So he said to Vespasian, give the Jewish people a city of Yavne, where we can build an academy, we'll be protected from persecution, etc., where we can rebuild. Vespasian says, your wish is granted. And indeed, this is what happens. The temple falls. The sages relocate. Many Jews relocate to Yavne. Yavne becomes the seat of Torah scholarship in Israel. It's the greatest academy of its time. And it's in this academy in Yavne, post-temple destruction, in the first century. So the temple was destroyed around the year 70. So somewhere in that last 30 years of century number one of this common era, this debate takes place between the very same students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, namely Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. So let's take a look at the debate as it's recorded in the Talmud, word for word, verbatim. Text 1a. Ezra, please take it away.
Achnai.
Okay. They're arguing about an oven. The oven is what is at stake right here. What's the deal with this oven? Was anybody able to create a mental image of the oven based on the description here, or was it too vague? What does the oven look like? Where? That's not really it. But no, don't look at this oven. What is it? Okay, here we go. You ready? That's your oven. How is it constructed? There we go. Went too fast. You see that? Coils of clay with sand in between, a little roof on top, and a little mortar and cement on the outside, and a fire on the inside. Looks nice and toasty in there. All right, that's your oven. Make sense? It's like a pizza oven. But it's made, again, the critical point here is not what we use it for, but how it's constructed. And the critical point of the construction is this. Again, it's separate layers that are filled in with sand and then covered. So it's, at the end, it's a complete unit. But on the inside, it's made of fragmented pieces. Here's the question. Simple question. Do you look at it as one piece? Is it an oven? Or is it fragments of clay with sand separating it? Understand? Again, do you look at it from the outside? What is it? It's an oven! It's an oven! It's covered with cement or mortar on the outside. It's an oven! As I was saying, you're not going to shine it. You know, don't bother. It's an oven. Don't worry. Or do you say, wait a second, not so fast. It's got separate layers, separate coils of clay with sand in between. The sand is not mortar. The sand is sand. The sand is loose. There's nothing binding the layers together. It's just gravity. A mortar on top, but the mortar's on the outside. You got to look beyond the surface. Don't judge a book by its insides, said my friend the graphic designer. Right? So don't judge an oven by... So here's the dispute, and let me explain how this dispute fits into the issue. Now, this is all about the oven. Now let's deal with the issue of ritual impurity. So in the times of the temple, there were certain food items. If you were a Kohen or a Levi and you got special foods like the Truma or the Maaser, the special tithes that you would receive, you could not eat them if you were in a state of ritual impurity, which is called Tameh. You could not eat them while Tameh. You had to eat them while you were Tahar, while you were pure. In addition, if you wanted to go to the Temple Mount, you also had to be personally in a state of ritual purity and not impure. Now, how does one become ritually impure? typically through contact with a dead body. Death coming in attack. But here's another point. Another way to become ritually impure is not by directly coming into contact with death, but by coming into contact with something that came in contact with death. In other words, it's second generation. Some vessel, some item comes in contact, God forbid, with a mess, with a debt, with death. Then you come in contact with that item. The person then becomes ritually impure. The question is, what kind of utensil, what kind of item, what kind of vessel becomes impure when it comes in contact with the body? Everyone with me so far? Again, if a person touches a dead body or is in the same under the same roof as a dead body, become ritually impure. If you're not, but you touch an item, you touch a bowl that was in that same house as the dead body, God forbid, you become ritually impure. But what types of items, what types of vessels become ritually impure? Jewish law says, listen to this, only a whole vessel, only a whole utensil, only an item that has integrity. Whereas, if you have a vase and it's smashed, and you have a broken vase, you have broken shards of pottery or clay, and they come in contact with death, they cannot become ritually impure. We're going to get to the Kabbalah of this. We're going to get to this, the mystical reason why, later on in the class. But just know this from a legal perspective. If something is broken, in other words, it's no longer together, it's no longer in the category of a vessel, it's not broken, it's not a vessel. So if it's not a vessel, it cannot become ritually impure. So paradoxically, the fact that it's broken ensures that it remains pure. It can never become impure. Does it make sense? Only if it's whole is it a vessel, and vessels can become impure, but not if it's broken. Make sense? Now we can understand the dispute. Rabbi Eliezer says, he declares the oven to be, look back inside, permanently pure, tahar. Rabbi Eliezer says the oven is always pure, it can never become ritually impure. Why? Why? Because it's not whole. It's not whole, right? If it's whole, it could be. You with me?
Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out something. What would you have? What is completely surrounded, with the exception of a bowl that has no opening?
If you put, I believe that Rabbi Lazar would say, would concede, that if in between each layer of clay there was something of a more solid substance, a sticky substance, something like a cement that was holding the layers themselves together, that would do it for him. That would do it for him. If it has structural integrity from the inside, not a problem. The issue here is, it might be covered out. By the way, we don't know the degree of the integrity of that coating from the outside. It may have had a very haphazard, you know, layer on the outside. But the inside, it was basically separate layers separated by sand. So Rabbi Eliezer says, it's not a vessel. It's a bunch of pieces, a bunch of broken pieces that happen to be laying on top of each other. It's not a vessel. Therefore, can't become impure. Again, paradox. If it's not a vessel, it can't become impure. It remains forever pure. Whereas the sages, the majority of the sages, disagree. It is susceptible to ritual impurity. It is a vessel. It can become impure. It doesn't mean that it is ritually impure. It means it could become ritually impure if it came in contact with death. Does it make sense?
Why would something that is broken not be impure, where something that's whole
be impure? The simple answer is that Jewish law says that a vessel can become impure. If it's not a vessel, can't become impure. That's a simple answer. We're going to get later on to the Kabbalah, to the mystical reason behind it. But the simple understanding is, it has to be something in order for it to become impure. Broken vessel is not a something. It's broken. So it's not something that can become now impure. It's impervious to impurity because it doesn't have a to'ar, it doesn't have a description, doesn't have a definition anymore, doesn't have a name. Whereas a vessel that has integrity, a vessel has an identity, now it could become impure. It doesn't make it impure. That itself, the fact that it's a whole vessel, doesn't make it impure, but it can become impure. Hold that idea. We can talk about that. Maybe we're going to touch on that, but hold that idea for much later. So right now, I just want to lay out the dispute. So far, so good. That's taught in a Mishnah. Rabbi Eliezer says one thing. The majority say the other thing. And that's typically how disputes go down in the Mishnah, how they're recorded. The Talmud records it here. Everything seems fine. Until we hit text 1b. And 1b is a whopper of a text. All right, Adina Malka. It's all you.
On that day, Rabbi Eliezer brought forward an imaginable argument to prove that the covenant is not subject to ritual divine, if the sages did not accept his arguments. Said Rabbi Eliezer, if the halakha agrees with me, let this carob tree prove. Thereupon the carob tree was uprooted and moved a distance.
Pretty heavy stuff. It's a heavy reading. Miracles, arguments, miracles, the decision, and excommunication all in one text. That's pretty much... Well, by the way, why did it take all the things that Rabbi Eliezer declared pure and burn them? He thought they were pure, yeah. He said they were pure because the Achnai oven is pure, so it's... No. The oven, what the oven caused to be impure. In other words, the things... The oven, the question is the oven a carrier of impurity? Can it be a carrier of impurity? Rabbi Ezra said it can't, because it's not an oven, it's broken pieces. The sages said yes. They argued about it. Rabbi Eliezer brought miracles as a proof. They rejected it. He brought a voice from heaven. They rejected that. The next thing you know... They're declaring all the things that he had declared pure, impure, burning them. And then they excommunicate him. And I have to tell you, the end of the story is the excommunication lasted until his passing. So the story that we just read begs for a deeper explanation, begs to be explained further. There are so many questions we can ask. I want to stick to three. I want to start with three questions. First of all, does anybody have any questions that they want to ask in the story?
If God was involved himself, how do the sages take precedence over God?
Perfect. That's my first question. Very good. I love this. Wait, hold on, because maybe we'll come up with the second one as well. But let me elaborate on that. The question is, why don't the sages, the majority sages, why don't they yield to Rabbi Eliezer? He's showing them miracles. One, a carob tree. We have live footage. Not live footage. We have footage of the carob tree. What is this now? We already did this. All right, it's like old news. Right? Ooh, baby, look at that. We have a carob tree moving. This is like a school play where some kid is like the tree and is just, you know, walking off set. Okay, carob trees are moving. Streams are flowing upwards. Walls are falling. Heavenly voices are being proclaimed. And the sages, we're not moving. We're not budging. Our opinion stands. Do they know more than heaven? They know better?
They said that they were following the Torah.
They said they're following the Torah, but a heavenly voice says, yo, we got an exception here.
But they said it's not God.
I don't know. It seems a little strange. What do you have?
Why doesn't Eliezer
came in? Ah, that's my second question. This is a beautiful thing. This is a beautiful thing. Question number one is on the sages. Why don't you give in? He's showing you miracles, showing you a heavenly voice, right, saying Eliezer is always right. So concede. Question number one. Question number two is, if for whatever reason, indeed, the law is always, as Jan said, the law always accords with the majority, heavenly voices notwithstanding, the law always follows the majority, so Rabbi Eliezer knows this, Rabbi Eliezer studied some Torah in his day, he's got some Torah experience under his belt, so how come he doesn't concede to the majority opinion? No, the majority says it's impure or could become impure. It is a vessel. It is an oven. Concede. Achrei rabim lahatos. My bar mitzvah Torah portion. Parshas Mishpatim. Achrei rabim lahatos. You follow the majority. Straight up. Exodus 22 or 23. Where is it from? Exodus 23. So why doesn't he concede? Why don't they yield to a voice of heaven? Number one. On the other hand, how come he doesn't concede to the majority? Question number three. They made such a big issue about an oven. Oh, I should have asked if anybody had this question. Oh, well. Well, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. We're batting 667. That's like, or 666. Such a big deal about an oven? This brought down everything? This was like the one case that we read about in the Talmud where there's this major impasse. And like no one can proceed. They're not yielding. He's not yielding. They're stubborn. We're the majority. I'm right. I'm the single opinion. It's like this whole, no one's blinking. They excommunicate him. The excommunication lasts until he dies. That's it. And by the way, excommunication is not just I'm defriending you on Facebook. Or unfriending. I'm not sure if it's defriending or unfriending. Either way, it's a serious deal in Judaism. Excommunication? Terrible. They excommunicated him. Over an oven? This is how everything blew up over an oven? The oven of Achnai? What's the deal with the oven? So Susan Handelman, she's a professor at Bar Ilan, she asked the question. I love how she writes this. Text number 2. Jan, take it away. Do you guys agree? I mean, I agree with that. It's like it's an oven. Alright, it's pure, it's impure. Alright, get over it. Everyone's digging their heels into the proverbial sand between the layers of clay. And like, that's it. We're not yield. That's it. This becomes the end all and be all. And this, what's up with that? Continue.
Practically speaking, the implication of the debate was that those who followed the sages' view would not be able to Still left with our question. Why does R. Eliezer so stubborn? stubbornly insist on his stance? And why does even heaven agree with him? But his colleagues nevertheless refuse. And not only refuse, but they also burn all the objects he has declared pure and ostracize him. What snake in the garden causes this expulsion and its terrible consequences?
All right, we got three questions. Why don't the sages concede? Why doesn't Rabbi Eliezer concede? And why is the oven at the center of this absolute firestorm?
Question.
Yeah.
Is there any other point, any other times when there were miracles, that the miracles themselves did not overshadow any objection?
It's a great question. It's a good question. I don't know, but I feel like I should be performing one right now. Just to kind of mix things up. I know like a magic trick or two. Is there any time that a miracle was performed to no avail? I don't know. I don't know if there's another time. But certainly it didn't work here. The sages are like, yeah, whatever. You're still not getting my... What was it? You're still not getting my Bud Light? What was it? What was that commercial? All right. Coke? What was it? Something. Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's about the oven. It's about Rabbi Eliezer raised the bar. It's really about what the bar was. It could have been the oven, could have been the pillow, could have been anything.
So you're saying it's not about the oven, but what we're going to get to today is discover what is it about the oven that speaks deeply to the issues that exist here between the sages. I don't mean issue, but between in this debate. In other words, the oven does. I hear what you're saying. There's a deeper issue here. But after, when we explain the deeper energies beneath the surface, we'll understand how the oven is actually the perfect embodiment of the tension that exists underlying in the story. So let's begin. But before we actually start explaining things, I want to ask, I actually like this question for discussion. I don't always like them, but I like this one on 166. With whom do your greater sympathies lie? I love this question. Who do you sympathize with? Rabbi Eliezer or Rabbi Yeshua and the sages? Who do you sympathize with?
Eliezer.
Rabbi Eliezer?
Yeah.
Why? Why? Who? Whoever? If you said Rabbi Eliezer, why do you sympathize with him more?
He was
banned. Okay, what else? Excommunicated? He believed in what he believed, and he even had a vote from heaven. Huh?
Well, enough to walk away.
Enough to walk away. Okay, good. What else?
Miraculous events prove what he said was correct.
And it would seem, right? All right. Who? Anybody sympathize with Rabbi Yeshua and the sages?
Because they had to stand up against what they thought, but it still appeared to them to be God.
Right. Oh, so they had to have the courage to... Okay, good, good, good. All right, so you... Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like I said, the Torah is not in heaven, and the consensus of all the sages is actually what makes up halakha.
So you're saying, so you're agreeing, I answer you're agreeing with, do you sympathize with him more, or do you feel bad for, who do you feel bad for? Who got the raw end of the deal here? Okay, all right, so let's see, I like that. I can see both sides. Feel bad for Rabbi Eliezer, he was excommunicated, he really believed in it. Feel bad for the sages, they had to cut the cord, they had to cut that connection between one of their colleagues. It's not an easy thing. Yeah.
But for some reason, the way the story is told, I think there's sympathy.
You could be, because it came down, they came down pretty hard on him, they burnt all the stuff, not his stuff, but they burnt all the stuff that he declared pure there. It could not have been fun. When my phone is out of battery for 5 minutes, it feels desolate. It's a joke. Huh? I don't know. We have to go back to... No, it was a Monday. It was a regular oven. Some say it was called Achnoi oven because the guy who designed it, his name was Achnoi. Some say Achnoi is related to like a snake, like coils of a snake. Somehow in Hebrew it's related, or Aramaic. So it's like this issue was encircled and snared in questions and debates. So it's like a snake. I don't know who designed it. According to one opinion, it's some dude Achnoi. I'm not sure what he was thinking. But this was the debate. This is where everything went down. Yeah.
So this, the sum and substance of it is the fact that the three coils of the oven were not connected then.
Nachon. Yes, correct.
And that was the subject. That was the.
That's what brought all this stuff down, is the fact that there was just sand between it, and it was could be considered separate pieces comprising this oven. Jan?
So it said that he was excommunicated, and it lasted until he died.
You can have, it's like a detox shake. It's like the excommunicator. Yeah, theoretically it could be lifted. It could be lifted, yeah.
But does it mean he's excommunicated me after that?
No, they released it upon his passing. It's not a happy story. Not a happy story. The ending.
I have difficulty with the idea that the decisions of man can trump the decisions of God.
Great. I agree. I also have an issue with that. That was our first question. How does that make sense? How does it make sense that they should trump heaven? And if they do, because the Torah says so, which is hard to understand, so how come Rabbi Eliezer didn't concede? And what's with the deal with the oven? All right, good.
Even in Egypt, and leaving Egypt, many times, the majority said, go back to Egypt. Let's not cross the Red Sea.
Now you're getting to the question of when is a majority a majority? When do you listen, when you follow a majority? Good. Lots of good questions.
But
heavenly voice, yeah. Heavenly's close. It's in the same zip code. All right. Heaven, God speaking. All right, here's the deal. Before we can answer, all right, everyone, so far we're all good. We're good with this? No, we're not good with this. We have lots of questions. All right, but we're good with the questions. So before we proceed to reconstruct the story in its totality. By the way, the idea is, like our Achnai oven, to actually rip it apart, to lay out all the pieces, and to put it back together again, and hopefully not end up with, as guys do often, with extra pieces and screws. Oh, you don't need that anyway. Oh, it's not. Right, no, but really put it back together where everything is seamless and perfect, but now we see it from an elevated perspective, and from a deeper perspective. That's the plan. But first, I'll ask another question. Here's the question. What's the deal with the miracles? What is the deal with the miracles? You would think, they're debating a point of Jewish law. The Talmud says in text 1b, we read it, Adina Maka, you read it. Rabbi Eliezer, that day, offered every argument in the world. They wouldn't accept it. So what does he pull out of his pocket? Miracles. Is this Yavne Got Talent? I mean, what is this? Is this like, miracles? Miracles? Shmiracles. What's going on here? What's the deal with the miracles? What's the deal with the shmiracles? You have a debate, an academic debate, a Torah debate. And when one side sees that it's not working out, so he makes a carob tree jump. He makes a stream flow backwards. What is that? Have a debate, have a discussion. What does the miracle help? Is this a talent show? Number one. Say it again. Turns out he was speaking to the walls, right? No, Rabbi Yeshua said, oh, you better not fall on us. And they stopped, but they were scared of Rabbi Eliezer, so they didn't go back the other way. But what does it mean? What's going on here? Was he bringing out the mirror? Okay, that's question number one. Question number two is, I know it's like really question number four, number five, but just work with me here. Each section is going to have its own series of questions. So question number one is, why does he evoke miracles? How do miracles help in academic discussion? Either you're right or you're wrong, because you could do a miracle, it doesn't mean anything. Number two. If the issue is that miracles don't mean anything, how come the sages, the majority of the sages, don't say, why don't they say simply, Rabbi Eliezer, with all due respect, we know you're a holy guy, and carob trees, streams, and walls will listen to you, but miracles don't actually mean anything. That's not what they say. They don't say miracles are irrelevant to our conversation. What do they say? Precisely. No proof can be brought from a carob tree. No proof can be brought from a stream of water. They don't say no proof can be brought from a miracle. They specify the miracle, which leads us to the next question. Sugazunt. Why is it that Rabbi Eliezer brings three miracles? If his point is, look what I can do, and therefore I'm right, because I'm this supernatural miracle worker, why isn't one sufficient? Why three? And again, the key question is, why don't they just say simply, Rabbi Eliezer, we're trying to have an academic, a Torah discussion. Why are you bringing miracles? They don't say that. They don't say miracles are irrelevant to the conversation. They say no proof can be brought from a carob tree. No proof can be brought from a stream of water. No proof can be brought from walls, etc. In other words, a good question is the answer. In other words, it points us to the answer. The answer is that he meant something specific with these miracles. When he made a carob tree move, he meant something specific. He had a lesson that he wanted to teach them about the debate, about the discussion at hand. And when the water flowed backwards, there was also a specific message. And when the walls fell, there was also a specific message. It wasn't just, look, supernatural miracles, now that you're distracted, I'm right. It was a specific message. What were the messages here contained within these three miracles? The Vilna Gaon, hold on 1 second. The Vilna Gaon, who we cited last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, maybe all the classes, the Vilna Gaon gives a beautiful explanation. He says as follows, Rabbi Eliezer felt as follows, I'm giving my best Torah arguments, and either they're not getting it, or they don't want to get it. In other words, either they're not comprehending it, because they're not comprehending it, or they don't want to comprehend it. Either way, I know I'm giving them logical, sound arguments. Rabbi Eliezer is saying to himself. So you know what? He says to them, I want you, if for whatever reason you're not capable or willing to accept my arguments, to understand my arguments, accept the simple point that my Torah knowledge is greater than yours. It sounds arrogant, but he meant it in order to achieve what he felt was the right decision when it comes to understanding Jewish law, when it comes to understanding Torah. He's saying, acknowledge, concede this point to me. Concede this law to me based on the fact, I know you're not, I'm giving you arguments, you're not getting it. But it's fine. You don't have to get the arguments. Just acknowledge that my Torah scholarship is superior to yours. By the way, he was right. Three points he puts out there. Number one, a carob tree. What's the meaning of the carob tree? Our sages tell us what a carob tree is all about. Carob tree is a sign of poverty. Carob tree is a sign of austerity. What does that mean?
Prosperity or poverty?
Poverty, austerity. The idea of somebody being not materialistic. Somebody being very disassociated from materialism. It says in the Talmud, famously, who was it? One of the great Talmudic sages used to eat caribs. Why? Because caribs have just a little bit of... You ever tried to eat caribs? Anybody eat caribs? Huh? It's like chalk, you could break your teeth on them. They have like a little bit of pulp in the inside. I mean, it's not much to eat. So caribs represent, at least in Talmudic parlance, caribs represent the notion of really cutting down on materialism. Like not like the opposite of indulgence in materialism. Which is one of the keys to achieving Torah. As we see in text number 3. Raisel, I think we're up to you. Text 3, page 167.
This is the way to acquire Torah. Bread with salt you shall eat, water in small measures you shall drink, and upon the ground you shall sleep. A life of deprivation you shall lead while you toil and study of Torah.
It says in Pirkei Avos, chapter 6, those of you that are with us Sunday mornings at Kabbalah and Coffee are familiar with this quote. We're studying it right now. Kachi darko shel Torah, this is the way to acquire Torah. Eat a little bread with some salt, eat water, drink water in small measure, and sleep on the ground. In other words, what does this mean? Simply speaking, the less material distractions you have, the more you can study Torah. Says Rabbi Eliezer, concede to me this point, because this is how I live. Historically, we know this is true. Rabbi Eliezer grew up in a very wealthy household. And his father did not want him to go to yeshiva. What did he want him to do? Stay in the family business. He left home at a young age, and he dedicated himself to Torah study. The Talmud says that he ate very little. He lived this. He lived this Darka Shel Torah, this way to acquire Torah. He lived the way of the carob tree. And so when he did the miracle with the carob tree, demonstrated to them, you know who you're arguing with? I'm the carob tree guy. Right? He was renowned for his austerity.
But didn't we learn that Rachel didn't believe that?
True. But that's already the deeper idea. But on a basic level, less distractions equal more opportunity to study Torah.
To me, I did a carob tree, stream of water, involved the academy. You know, Hashem has three aspects. God who is, God who was, God who always will be. And so for a tree, as we know, it has to start, when we see one today, and we see a carob tree growing, or any tree growing, we know that it started way back in the past. And the stream of water, that's where it's going to be going. We see the water, we know it's going someplace, that's like seeing toward the future. And then the walls of the academy, well, that's what it is. And so to me, you're sure that he wasn't only talking those three aspects of Hashem.
Could be.
Are showing him.
Not bad. I like. The Vilna Gaon says something differently. I like the explanation, but the Vilna Gaon is saying clearly that he was trying to give them the message that although you may not get my arguments, at least concede that my scholarship is superior. Why? Because my austerity is greater than the majority of the sages. The next miracle was the stream of water. What's water? What does water symbolize? Two things: humility and Torah. Water symbolizes humility that is a key component to studying Torah. We see this in text 4, which comes from the Talmud. 167, Chana, please take it away.
Why are the words of the Torah likened to water, as in the verse, "Oh, all who are thirsty go to the water"? This teaches us that just as water flows from a higher place to a lower one, so too the words of Torah are retained only by one who is humble.
If you want to retain the words of Torah, you have to be humble. Rabbi Eliezer was intimating with this miracle of the stream of water flowing upwards that he had the lock on humility as well. Now you would say, oh, that's pretty arrogant to say how humble you are. But the reality is that it's not a mitzvah to be ignorant of your own virtues. And humility doesn't mean that you don't think that you're a great person or that you're humble. I.e., it doesn't mean that you don't know that you're humble. You can know that you're humble. You just have to know that it's not because of you that you have all these gifts, but they come from Hashem. Humility really means that you know, you acknowledge your gifts, you know what you have, you know your abilities, but you also know that it comes from Hashem. So therefore, you're humble. He knew that his gifts came from Hashem. He knew that his gifts came from God. So he wasn't arrogant about it, but he knew he was also humble. So he was pointing out there his humility. In fact, Rabbi Eliezer, historically, the Talmud records famously, never taught any law, at least this is what he claimed. He never taught a law that he had not heard from his teacher, Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, the guy who was smuggled out of the walls, was his teacher. He never quoted something outside of the name of his teacher. So what's the point? The point is, he had this tremendous value of humility. And what do the walls symbolize? So that's what he symbolized with the miracle of the water. And what about the walls? The walls are another quality. The walls literally refer to clocking hours in the base medrash. Clocking hours in the academy. What do the walls mean? The miracle of the walls, it means those walls and him spent lots of quality time together. In fact, the Talmud tells us that no one spent more time in the academy as Rabbi Eliezer. He was the first one there in the morning and the last one to leave at night. No one literally clocked more hours in the base medrash than him in the academy. So therefore, and we have this in text 5. Charna, please take it away.
I believe scholarship can be found by those who come to the study hall early in the morning and stay late.
The Talmud says, Who has scholarship? If you put in the hours, you'll have scholarship. Who has Torah? If you're humble, you have Torah. What's the path to Torah? If you minimize your attachment to the material, Rabbi Eliezer famously had all three of these qualities of austerity, humility, and diligence. And he was demonstrating that to his colleagues.
Was he
all by
himself in this?
Yes.
Everybody else was against
him? He was a yachid. Yeah, he was all alone. That's as far as we know, he was all alone. The Talmud and the Mishnah do not record any fellow dissenting opinions along with his. He was the only one. His point with it to the sages were, you might not understand my arguments, and that's fine. But can't you just concede that my scholarship is superior to yours? And therefore just say, we don't understand how or why, but we'll give you this one. We'll rely. It gets even better. A voice rings out from heaven. It says, why are you guys even trying? Remember the words? Text 1b? The halacha, the law, always follows Rabbi Eliezer in every case. He's always right. Do you know what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the same teacher who was smuggled out of the walls of Jerusalem, do you know what he said? Text number 6, Howard.
Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say, all the sages of Israel were on one hand balance scale, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Arachanus was on the other. He would outweigh them all.
Yochanan ben Zakkai said, if you put them on a scale, all the other sages in the world, put them on a scale on one side of the scale. Rabbi Eliezer, our Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, same Rabbi Eliezer, on the other side of the scale, guess who outweighs them all? Rabbi Eliezer. That's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the teacher of him and Rabbi Yeshua. That's what he said. The founder of the Academy of Yavne himself said, Rabbi Eliezer is vastly superior. The heavenly voice said vastly superior. Rabbi Eliezer said, look, you might not get my arguments. And that's fine. But concede that I'm right. I have vastly superior Torah knowledge.
So theoretically, he is the majority.
We're going to get there in a second. We're going to get there in a second. That's a very... We're going to get there in a second. So... Now really the question is, why in the world are they not relenting to the opinion of Rabbi Eliezer at that point? And they don't even provide rejoinders to his arguments. They don't say, you're not so austere, you're not so humble, you're not so diligent, you're not so studious, you're not so great, you were, but we're better than... They don't even say that. They simply say to Rabbi Eliezer the following. Your points are irrelevant and are inadmissible in a halachic discussion. They simply tell him, you may be right. You may have superior Torah knowledge. You might be more humble. You may... Doesn't make a difference. All of these points are inadmissible in a scholarly halachic debate. The question is why? To understand all of this, we need to look closely at the personalities. And here's where we peel back the curtains all the way. Here's where we just blow the top off of this achnoi of them. And we get down to the clay and sand of the issue. Who were these personalities? I just gave you a little bit of insight into Rabbi Eliezer. Who really were they? Who was Rabbi Eliezer? Who were the sages? Specifically, who was Rabbi Yehoshua? When we take a closer look at the personalities involved, we find something amazing and fascinating. Years earlier, Rabbi Yehoshua, the same Rabbi Yehoshua, who thunders back to those walls, oh, you better not fall on us. That same Rabbi Yehoshua, who thundered, lo b'shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven. The Torah itself says it's not in heaven. Acharei rabbim lahatos, the law follows the majority. The same Rabbi Yehoshua, years earlier, found himself in the same position of being a minority view against the majority. Here's what went down. It was still the times that the Jews had the Sanhedrin, the high court in Jerusalem. And at that point in time, Rosh Chodesh, the new Jewish month, was set not by the calendar, but rather, how was it set? By the moon. How'd they know when the new moon was? Two witnesses. Two kosher witnesses showed up to that high court, to that Sanhedrin. And they said, we saw the new moon. What does it mean, the new moon? The moon's never old or new. But it means the appearance of the moon after it had waned so much that it disappeared from sight. Then it comes, it's a new moon. So the two witnesses come to Jerusalem, to the high court, and they said, we saw the moon. They're investigated. What angle did you see it? And they, of course, the sages knew a little bit about astronomy, and they knew the calculations. So if everything matched, and the two witnesses' stories were corroborated, if they were able to get the same story from two people, they pronounced that day Rosh Chodesh. And if that's the first of the month, now you can establish the rest of the month, and of course, when the holidays will fall out. Because every holiday is associated, typically every holiday, except for Shavuot, is associated with a date of the month. It's either, for example, Rosh Hashanah is the first day of the month, Tishrei. Yom Kippur is the 10th day of the month of Tishrei. Sukkot is the 15th day of that same month. So you have to know when the holidays are, in order to know when the holidays are, you have to know when the month starts. They didn't go by the calendar. What happened was, one time, two witnesses came to Jerusalem. And they testified. New moon. The Sanhedrin says, done. Rosh Chodesh, happy holiday. Rosh Chodesh is a mini holiday. Rosh Chodesh, Mazal Tov. It's established. Rabbi Yehoshua, remember Rabbi Yehoshua, who's now in our story, the majority opinion, Rabbi Yehoshua says, incorrect. Incorrect. I know astronomy, and there's no way they saw that moon. I know astronomy. There's no way they saw that moon. Not legit. Zelo emet. It's not true. Not only is it not true, it's an impossibility. The leader of the Sanhedrin at that time was a sage by the name of Rabban Gamliel. By the way, you will not be quizzed on all these names after the class. But you can still write them down if you want. Rabbi Gamliel was the head of the high court of the Sanhedrin. He comes back and he says, not only is it Rosh Chodesh, it was the month of Tishrei. Not only is it Rosh Chodesh, but in 10 days from now? Sorry. You think, you Rabbi Yeshua, think a different day is Rosh Chodesh? Which means that there's a different day as Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur. On that day that you think is Yom Kippur, I want you to come to me with your wallet and your walking stick. In violation of what you believe will be Yom Kippur, the 10th day of the month. Because according to your calculations, you think it's different than the way we're calculating it. You're going to come to me on Yom Kippur. We're going to go to Starbucks. I'm paraphrasing. Didn't actually say that. Huh? You call it moon bucks, because alright. Exactly. Let's start. Good. Very good. Text number 7. Text number 7. You ready, Jay? Wanna read?
Rabbi Yeshua took his staff and his money and went to
and went to Yahweh, the rabbi Gamliel, on the day in which Yahweh fell, according to his record. Rabbi Gamliel rose, kissed Rabbi Yeshua on his head, and said, "Come in peace, I'm my teacher and my disciple. You are my teacher and wisdom. You are my disciple. I have been following my instructions."
Rabbi Yeshua, what he's told by, he's ordered by Rabbi Gamliel to show up with your money and your staff on the day that you believe is Yom Kippur. What does he do? He does it. Why? Because he was the minority opinion. In an amazingly ironic twist of fate, the same Rabbi Yeshua who years later, when Rabbi Eliezer was the minority opinion, thundered back and said, "Acharei Rabbim Lahatis, you must follow the majority. You could bring miracles all you want, and you might be smarter, and you might be more brilliant. It doesn't make a difference. You have to follow the majority." He himself lived through that. He was the minority opinion when it came to when you established Rosh Chodesh and when Yom Kippur would fall out. But he acted differently than Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer, in our story, to the bitter end, would not concede, would not cede one inch. He would not say, "You're right, I'm wrong." He would not say, I'll follow you, what you say. To the very end, he said, "I am right. No one is going to tell me any differently." Whereas Rabbi Yeshua, when he was faced with the same situation, Rabbi Yeshua picked up his staff and took his money and he went to Yavin and to Rabbi Gamliel on the day that he felt was Yom Kippur.
But in that sense, was he like saying, I'm still thinking that I'm right. I'm coming on the day that I think the holiday.
No. What the point was, the day that he thought was Yom Kippur and therefore would be prohibited from carrying his staff and his money, Rabbi Gamliel said, to prove that you're acting in accordance to the way we've established the calendar, you're going to violate Yom Kippur. In other words, I don't want you in your house keeping Yom Kippur on your day. No. You're going to follow our count. And he does it.
Because with what happened with Rabbi Yeshua, he had an opinion which he retracted. You know, he said, "Well, I agree with the majority, and I'm carrying my staff, money."
Yeah.
But the other guy, Rabbi
Yehazar,
he had three big miraculous events to say, "No, we agree with what he said."
I'm with you.
So in other words, to me, it's not the same thing. It's one thing for a person to say, I was wrong, you're right. But here's the point. He's not saying I was wrong.
The similarity is they both knew that they were right. Rabbi Yeshua in his case knew he was right. Rabbi Eliezer in his case knew he was right. Rabbi Yeshua in the case where he knew he was right. Forget about Rabbi Yeshua concedes. Rabbi Eliezer will not concede. He will not give in. The question is why. Now, in general,
it would have been heresy from his perspective.
Who?
From Rabbi Eliezer's.
Rabbi Yeshua's also.
It would have been heresy for him to, ask for the miracles to occur if he was right, for them to occur, and then say, "Okay, after all, okay."
I don't know if it's heresy. It's conceding. It's understanding that halacha works by majority. Look, Hold on. We're gonna get to a much deeper place in a second to understand the depth of the issue here. The difference between the way each responds to their personal crisis of halacha, of their opinion of Jewish law. The difference between how Rabbi Yeshua responds and Rabbi Eliezer responds. In order to understand this, we need to look at the historical debates that occur between the two. In general, sometimes you have many debates, many machlokes, and you have many disputes between two different opinions that are on different topics, totally different topics and unrelated topics. But one of the beautiful things of Torah scholarship is that when you look a little bit deeper, you can many times find core points of dispute that are driving each and every other dispute. In other words, you can distill many different arguments down to one central point, how two people looked at one central point differently, and because of that was mista'ef, from that branched off all of these different arguments. So you have one core distinction a perspective that from there evolves many different arguments. The same thing is true when it comes to Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer. Susan Handelman, as Dr. Handelman indicated in her text, I think it was text 3 or text 2, from the first page of the Talmud we find disputes between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. We find many, many disputes between them. And there's a core distinction. And what we're going to do now is some forensic Talmudic studies, which means we're going to look at two disputes between the two, and we're going to try to decipher, see if we can figure out what is driving their differences of opinion. So let's begin. The first of the two is going to be text number 8. Mike, please take it away. Text number 8, page 172. Who was Achillas? Some say he was Uncleus, the one who translated the entire Torah in Aramaic. Some say he was, no, different guy. Achillas lived in the same era, but he translated the Torah into Greek. Either way, he turned out to be a great Torah scholar. How would you characterize the distinction between the responses of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua? If you had to describe their personalities, what is Rabbi Eliezer saying? What's his personality and what's Rabbi Yehoshua's personality? Rabbi Eliezer says, chutzpah, what do you want? I'm paraphrasing a little bit. He's saying, this gift is trivial. God says he's going to give you bread and clothing. You want more? Be happy with what you get. Jacob was happy with this. What's the issue, man? Rabbi Yeshua, nah, bread is a metaphor for great, great blessings, and clothing also for great blessings. No, you have great blessings. How would you characterize? Rabbi Eliezer is dogmatic. Rabbi Yeshua? Sympathetic. Let's take a look at the next one. Text number 9. Melissa, please take it away. Yeah, please.
Talmud asks, why was Rabbi E critical of those who left in order to enjoy the holiday meal? After all, it is mandatory to rejoice on a holiday. Rabbi E, however, is of the opinion that rejoicing on a holiday is optional. For it is taught. Rabbi E says, a person has no absolute obligation on a holiday. He may choose to eat and drink, or he may sit and study Torah. Rabbi Yeshua says, divide the day, devote half of it to God and half of it to yourselves.
Understand what the debate is. Rabbi Eliezer said he's lecturing. It's a holiday. No, everyone's checking their watch. We prayed. Now we're getting a lecture. All right, it's good, but we also want to make kiddur. We want to go home and have a festive meal. I got some good brisket cooking. Or maybe it should. Say it again.
Rabbi E, very type A, very this.
Ah.
Yes, we're buried by mother. Yes, we're still
alive. Right. Good. So Rabbi Eliezer says, you're leaving a Torah discussion, a Torah lecture on the holiday to eat food? Are you kidding me? What a waste of time. He was like mocking them. Oh, they must have a barrel of wine. Oh, they must have a jug of wine. He was mocking them. Rabbi Yosha, because he's of the opinion that the Torah says that the holiday... Here, just put it up on the board.
So he almost sounds like a part of Leishadah.
Shammai. Yeah, we're going to get there in a second. So the Torah says like this, the holidays are an atzeret work stoppage for your God. And another, that's in Deuteronomy. In Numbers, it says it's an atzeret work stoppage for you. So one time it says for God, one time it says for you. So Rabbi Eliezer says like this, really, you should celebrate the holiday by dedicating it solely for God. In other words, study, prayer, that's it. Stay in the synagogue all day. How else are you going to celebrate a holiday? You're going to go home and eat? Are you kidding me? For God. If you can't hack it, fine. So forget about God, just eat, enjoy, whatever. Go home to your wine, go home to your other stuff, whatever. I don't, but it's like, shunning them. Rabbi Yeshua says, no, half the day for Hashem, half the day for you. In other words, it's not like if you can't hack this, if you're like, if you want the watered down version of the holiday, then fine, go eat your meal. No, originally, like the way it's done is, you go to shul and you daven a little bit and you study some Torah and then you go home for a festive meal. That's how you celebrate the holiday. Again, what we see here is that Rabbi Eliezer is very strict, very, very strict, very intense. I want to use the word intense. He's very intense. He's like, there's only one way to do the holiday. There's only one way to, right? Judaism, it's not about the rewards, it's about doing the right, etc. Whereas Rabbi Yeshua is more understanding, he's able to relate better to people. So I was actually going to do this as an exercise, which is on page 175. It's a really cool exercise, but we simply do not have the time to do it. We can say after the class to do it, but there's so much stuff to get through, I can't spend 5 minutes now on an exercise. The exercise was going to be fill in using some of these words that are here. Some of these words are just like red herrings to throw you off. But some of these words are actually relevant to the two personalities, and the idea would be to kind of sort them based on the personalities. So Rabbi Eliezer, for example, is critical, he's demanding, he's highly spiritual, he's maybe a little bit introverted, he's a perfectionist, he's a purist, he's a little bit severe, he's a utopian, right? He's all that type of thing. Whereas Rabbi Yoshua is more, compromising, moderate, kind, populist, sympathetic. Huh? Pragmatic, exactly. He's very right. He's very. You gotta know who you're dealing with. If a guy needs some extra encouragement, hook him up with some kind words. You don't have to be like, "Oh, how dare you ask for extra fringe benefits?" Right? Give him a little bit of encouragement. Help him out on his journey. Right? Why are you being so abrupt with him? People need to eat. Oh, you can't? So come on, like hook people up with a little bit. So this is, understand that in the words of Jewish philosophy and Kabbalah, the difference is chesed and gevura. These are classic phrases. Chesed is loving kindness, giving, forgiving, understanding. Pragmatic is very much being able to relate to others. Whereas gevura is very much strict. It comes from an intensity. There's a certain intensity there of perfection. It's got to be the perfect. It's got to be one way. It's a very intense energy. Gevura is. Gevura means might and strength. It's very intense. It's like, imagine like the clenched fist guy. Not that he's going to strike anything, but like very, very much like this. Whereas the chesed personality is much different. And it harkens back to two generations earlier. The debates between Hillel and Shammai. It says in the good books that Hillel and Shammai were the same. The great Hillel and Shammai, they lived in the times of the temple in the first century BC. They lived before the destruction of the temple. Hillel and Shammai. Hillel was chesed. He was more lenient. Shammai was more strict, was more severe, was more gvura. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a student. Interesting. So Hillel and Shammai, they each had their own academies, two different academies. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, we know who Rabbi Yochanan is, right? He's the guy who escaped Jerusalem. He was a student of Hillel, in the path of love, if you will. But Rabbi Yochanan's two students branched off again. And Rabbi Yeshua continued his legacy, Hillel's legacy of kindness. But Rabbi Eliezer clearly went the other way, to the other branch. Kind of along, more along the lines of Shammai. In fact, Deborah, please read text 10.
Rabbi Eliezer was a follower of Shammai.
Even though his teacher was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, whose teacher was Hillel, Rabbi Eliezer was a spiritual heir of Shammai. Why? All about the discipline. Discipline doesn't mean anything. All about the intensity. The intensity. Now we understand, by the way, why he responds harshly to the potential convert. Because that's his nature. He's perfection. It's got to be perfect. No questions. Either you want it or you don't want it. That's it. Either you want it or you don't want it. No fooling around. That's his personality. And then you have Rabbi Yeshua's personality is, it's going to be good. It'll be good. It'll be fun. Come on, come for the journey. More warm and loving and inviting. More of a pragmatist. It also explains about the holiday. So we got that, right? The holiday, different approaches to the holiday. Now, this is true in parenting as well. And by the way, it's not that chesed and gevurah is good versus bad. Or right versus wrong. There's two valid approaches in life. Think about parenting. There are two different types of parents. Right? Two different types of parents. One parent is the demanding parent. Demanding out of love. Understand that love is really driving the demand. It's love of perfection. It's, and how else are you going to be perfect if I don't hold you to a perfect standard? No, I gotta drive you a little bit to get you to that place. Whereas another parent will take a more laid back approach, more loving. So the truth is, you need both. But really, these are two different approaches. So this is again the classic distinction between Hillel and Shammai. It's the same distinction between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Now, we can understand a little bit about the oven. And why the oven was so significant. You had an oven. What would you have?
Just one question. Rabbi Yeshua contended that he was right as far as
Rosh Chodesh. Yes.
But the law in the book said you needed two.
Well, no, he didn't say that. He wasn't going to establish Rosh Chodesh. What he was saying is that the two witnesses' testimony should be thrown out of court because it was an impossibility. He wasn't going to establish it. He was just going to undermine. He was just going to say that you have to throw this testimony out. It's just not physically possible. Which was within the power of the courts to do. As I said before, the courts were supposed to have charts. And when they did have charts. They had astronomical charts. And when the witnesses came in, they were able to know if it was feasible or not. So the courts determined through whatever calculations they had, whatever charts they were using, and they said, yeah, feasible. Rabbi Yeshua said, I got the charts. And my charts say, didn't happen. So he wanted to throw out the testimony. It's not that he wanted to establish, he wanted to unestablish. By the way, if Rosh Chodesh, understand though, if Rosh Chodesh doesn't cut, there's only 2 days that it can possibly show up. The new moon. Just the way it works, the way it works in reality is there's only 2 possible days. So if it wasn't the first day, it had to have been the second day. So it would have been the next day. In other words, the next day would have been Yom Kippur for him. And basically what Rabbi Gamliel was demanding is the day after everyone else celebrates Yom Kippur, that he should walk around with his money and not celebrate a second Yom Kippur because that's his calculation. Now we can understand the oven. Comes along the oven. The oven is symbolic of the entire worldview distinction between these two rabbis. The oven is made up of broken pieces. The question is, are broken pieces okay? Or is it not perfect enough? Guess who says what? Rabbi Eliezer, the perfectionist, says what? It's broken. So therefore it's okay, therefore it's pure. He says, it's not an oven. Sand, and what's the Hebrew word for sand? Hebrew word for sand is chol. You know what chol means also? Mundane. Chol, ben kodesh l'chol. Chol means mundane, chol also means sand. What that means, the oven is not an oven, the oven is a human being. A human being who has a little bit of chol, who has a little bit of mundane, who's a little bit, who there's tension between the spiritual, who's not perfect. Rabbi Eliezer says, that's not a whole human being. It's a broken oven. It's not an oven. It's not a vessel for God. It's not whole. It doesn't have the integrity. Rabbi Eliezer is the perfectionist, is the intense perfectionist. He says, anything less than perfection is not good enough. It's not good enough. It's not an oven. And if you're not an oven, That's it. There's no impurity. Now, that sounds like a good thing, but it's not a good thing. The reason why there's no impurity... Huh?
That's what Rabbi
Yoshua... No, Rabbi Eliezer says it cannot be... Rabbi Eliezer says there's no oven. It's a bunch of broken pieces. The sand in the middle does not constitute an oven. It's not an oven. I said paradoxically, Jewish law says that if it's not a vessel, it's actually pure. Why? Here we get to the Kabbalah of it. Kabbalah says that impurity only rests where purity rests. In other words, because impurity tries to leech off... Listen to this. Impurity, tumah, impurity, leeches off holiness. That's what impurity tries to do. It tries to leech off holiness and derive nourishment from places of holiness. So if you have a whole vessel, if it's complete, so that's a holy unit, it's holistic. No pun intended. If it's whole, it could be holy. If it has integrity, it could be holy. So if you have a whole vessel, you can have holiness there. If you have holiness there, it's susceptible to becoming impure as well. Because impurity wants to be there. If holiness is there, impurity is like, hey, what's for dinner? Whereas if it's broken, so no holiness does not reside in a broken vessel, it doesn't have the integrity. So if there's no holiness there, there's no impurity there either. It's pure. It's pure because it can't become impure. Comes along Rabbi Eliezer and says, look at the oven. The oven's broken. And he holds intense, he's got that intense, that high standard of perfection, Rabbi Eliezer does. He's the Gvura. He says, you know what? It's got to be perfect or get out of here. Get out of town. Send you packing. This oven, see you later, my fellow. It's not an oven. There's no oven here. Chol, a human being that has sand, that has mundane drives and temptations, forget it. We write you off. You're broken. It's not whole. So there's no holiness, there's no impurity. It's just a broken vessel. Rabbi Yeshua says in the majority of these ages, say, Chas v'Shalom, God forbid. So what if there's a little bit of sand? Look on the outside. It looks like an oven, right? It functions like an oven. It tries very hard to be an oven. It does its best. You can't hold people to a perfect standard. You can't hold human beings. Say it again. Cut them some slack. That's what Rabbi Yeshua, that's what the sages are saying. That's what Rabbi Yeshua is saying. You gotta cut them some slack. Rabbi Yeshua says, look, you gotta be pragmatic. You can't be so idealistic. We don't live in a world of idealism. Idealism doesn't get you anywhere. Idealism gets you locked up, maybe. But idealism gets you excommunicated. That's where idealism gets you. You got to deal with people. You got to deal with what's the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is that not everyone's perfect. And you have to accept people for who they are. And they have holiness. You can't discard, you can't throw them out just because if you peel back the layers, you see a little bit of sand in there. It's okay. It's okay if there's a little bit of chol. They can still grow more and strive for more, but it doesn't mean that you just discard. It's not an oven. It's broken. Broken shards. It's not broken shards. It's an oven. It's an oven that's not yet perfect. It's okay. Rabbi Eliezer says, it's got to be perfect. It's got that intense energy of perfection. It's got to be perfect. He's the idealist, the Gevura. Rabbi Yeshua says, you might be right, from an idealistic perspective. You're right. But we live in a practical world, and in a practical world, you're not right. Rabbi Yeshua says, but I am right. Yeshua says, you're right in your own world, but you're not in our world. And our world is the majority of people are not perfect. We're not idealists. We have moments of idealism, but there are many more moments. The majority of moments are less than idealistic. So Rabbi Eliezer says, but you're looking at the wrong majority. Why look at the majority of people? Look at the majority of what's right. Look not at the majority of quantity, look at the majority of quality. And qualitatively, idealism is right. It's, after all, we call it the ideal for a reason. It's the ideal. If it's the qualitative ideal, if it's the right thing, so how could you ever have a majority on the other side. You can't have a majority on the other side. This is what Rabbi Eliezer was saying. Rabbi Eliezer wasn't saying, I know better than the Torah which says follow the majority. What he's saying, as was mentioned before, somebody mentioned it before, he has a different definition of what majority is. Straight up. He says, "You one man, one vote? It's not one man, one vote. If you're right, you get a vote. One man, one vote. But you're wrong. Who says you get a vote? You have to go by the ideal. If you have the ideal, if you speak in ideal, idealistic terms, you've got a vote. If you're less than ideal, who says you have a vote? In fact, if you just look at the statement, as we mentioned before, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, if you put all the sages on a scale, and Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus on the other side, he outweighs them all. Guess who's the majority now? What does it mean? It doesn't mean majority in numbers. It means majority in echos. It means majority not in kamos, not in quantity, but in quality. Qualitatively, he had the majority. Rabbi Eliezer was not saying, God forbid, that I disagree with Torah standards of Achrei Rabbim Lahatos, that you have to follow the majority. He was saying follow the majority, and he was saying, I, as a single person, am the majority. Welcome to the majority. That's me. Why? Because I am speaking from the place of idealism. And if it's perfectly true and right, then that's the way it is. If a vessel to be whole means that it's whole, so I demand nothing less than perfect wholeness. This oven that's not perfectly whole, that doesn't have perfect integrity, it's not an oven. And you can't argue with that. Rabbi Yeshua says you're right, but you're still being idealistic. And an idealist who is faced with the concept of majority is going to say that the majority is those who are idealistic. But you know what? You're still wrong. You're wrong because we're still not idealistic. And if you're not idealistic, then you go by the majority of those who are on the ground, one man, one vote. Now, we have to be careful here. I have to understand that even Rabbi Yeshua and the other sages, their opinion was rooted in Torah scholarship. So it wasn't like you go by any majority. This is the key distinction. It's not like you go by any majority because, frankly, most of the world is not Jewish. So if Jews follow the majority and most of the world is not Jewish, so then there goes Judaism. It means within the framework of Torah scholarship, we have two different opinions. So you go by the majority that most people can relate to. As long as it still can be authentically called Torah, it's you go by the majority. That's the way it works. So what Rabbi Yeshua was saying, I understand your perspective, but you've got the idealistic perspective, Rabbi Eliezer. Most of us can't hold to that perfect standard. If we can't hold to that perfect standard, so the majority says differently than you, and you have to concede to the majority. After all, that's what majority is all about. Majority is all about what's better for most people. Again, still within the Torah framework, but what's better for most people. And this, my friends, is the reason for the debate. The debate was stirred by the personalities of the respective disputants between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua. It was provoked by an oven. The oven that struck a nerve on both parties. This oven of brokenness, and that just brought out all of these underlying issues to the surface. Of, is brokenness okay? Do you consider brokenness to have integrity? Or do you demand a perfect integrity? Or demand perfection? With Rabbi Eliezer saying it's got to be perfection to be a vessel. And the sages led by Rabbi Yeshua saying you don't need to be perfection. And now we understand also why Rabbi Yeshua conceded in the case of Rosh Chodesh. Because again, he followed majority. He was able to concede and follow majority, whereas Rabbi Eliezer could not concede because he felt, I am the majority.
If something is built for a particular purpose, it serves that purpose, and it's met all the standards that particular item is supposed to be, why would it be considered broken?
You're still looking at it too literal. Rabbi Eliezer was saying, it's an oven, it's not an oven, it's a human being. The chol is not sand, it's that which is mundane, it's chol, it's like, it's bin kodesh l'chol, hamavdu bin kodesh l'chol. Yeah, but this one evoked this message. And by the way, the oven also, maybe it falls apart quicker than an oven that was built with greater integrity. Maybe it's like the difference between a MacBook with its unibody design and some Fakata HP that I have sitting, it's actually a nice computer, but something that's comprised of different layers. Maybe you drop it on the floor and this one busts to 3, 4, 5 pieces, whereas a MacBook with its integrity, with its unibody design, bounces off and laughs at the floor and says, ha, I'm stronger than you. but maybe the oven wouldn't last as long. Maybe that person's inspiration, when they're inspired, yeah, on the outside they look like they're doing the right thing, but maybe it's not seamless through and through. Rabbi Elazar says it's not legit. Rabbi Yeshua says it's legit enough. We'll work with this person. You got to cut them some slack.
That's why they have the little centers on campuses and not Shemai centers.
Exactly. Right, exactly. That's right. That's why it's more. I don't know if we have too many loose ends that we have not somehow tied up. Yeah. In other words, if it's broken, then it's not a vessel. Then no holiness resides there. If there's no holiness, then impurity doesn't want to have anything to do with it either. It's paradoxical. If it's not whole, if it's broken, it doesn't have holiness. Because it doesn't have integrity. If there's no integrity, if there's no holiness, then impurity doesn't want to go there either. Impurity is like, that's lame. Yeah.
What constitutes a vessel?
A vessel is something that has a function. Something that has a ta'ar, something that has a description. A piece of paper could be a vessel, like anything that has a use, a function. As opposed to like a randomly discarded like tree limb or something that does, unless it was designated as having some purpose, like a walking stick or something. But like if something is just... Now, let me just quickly, let's see if we... That's it. I think that's pretty much it. No, I mean, that's it until we get to the big finish. And here's the big finish. Hold questions to the end because we're like a few minutes after 9:30. I just want to quickly wrap. I want to point out one more significant detail. And if anybody has any questions on this, please stay after class and we'll schmooze it up. The leaning walls. Remember the third miracle? The walls were leaning. Rabbi Elazar said, if I'm right, may the walls lean. They started leaning. Rabbi Shu says, no, stop leaning. They stopped leaning. But they didn't go all the way back. You know what the message there is? The walls remain forever at an incline. What that means is, each one represented chesed. One represented chesed, one gvura, one that intensive. You know what the message is? You know what the ultimate takeaway is? The ultimate takeaway is both are right. Both are right in the sense of, you need to be idealistic also. It's a good trait. You also have to be pragmatic. It's also a good trait. It's either or is not great. Some would argue, you know, roles, for example, a father or a mother. So the father could be more like this, or vice versa. It doesn't make a difference. The point is that you really need, as a child, as a human being, you really need both influences. You need both the chesed. You need both the acceptance, but also that drive to a higher standard, toward perfection. You need both. That's the message of the walls that are leaning. It's also the same thing with regard to tzedakah. Not only character development, but also tzedakah, forgiving. So some say give indiscriminately. Give if somebody asks, give. Some say no, you have to be careful who you give it, where is it going for. The truth is in the middle. You give and you're also cautious. You give, but you also want to encourage the recipient to actually be proactive and to earn their keep, etc. The reality is, though, that as we strike a balance, if you have to err to one side over the other, in other words, if you have to slant a little bit more, which way should you go? Which way do you think? Chesed or Gevura? Chesed. The rule of thumb is you always go... And there's a beautiful statement of our sages that captures this. Burton, read this. This may be the last one that we're doing. Read text number... is it 16?
Yeah.
Go for it. What does that mean? The pushing away means, I'm holding you to a high standard. It's not good enough. That's like the gvura. The right hand is good, good, come here. But which one is dominant? Okay, in a world of righties. Oh, you lefty? Whoops. You know what? Do me a favor, reverse the text for you. But the majority, again, it's going by the majority. Majority of folks are righties, at least for argument's sake. And so the point is that your dominant hand, in other words, the more power should be invested in chesed and less power in gvura. So the idea is you do need to strike a balance. If you have to weigh one over the other, err to the side of chesed over gvura. That's the rule of thumb. Finally, one final point. Our sages tell us, and this is found in text 17. Jonathan, you want to read text 17?
Originally, it was God's intention to create the world with the mind after
which is Gevura.
God perceived, however, that the world would not endure ruler. He therefore made the attribute of mercy the dominant force of creation.
Rashi on the first and the opening verse in Genesis, the Bereshit says, quotes from the Midrash, something we've just studied in Kabbalah and Coffee also, that originally God wanted to create the world with this strict standard of Gvura, this intensity. He saw that it wasn't possible, so He tempered it with Chesed. And then the world endures. What does that mean? It means we don't live in a perfect world. And God knows we don't live in a perfect world. And because of that, He cuts us some slack. And we're told also to emulate God's ways. We can cut other people some slack also. We don't have to discard our ideals. But we also have to be understanding of the human condition and the challenges and the struggles that people go through. And be a little bit compassionate, be a little bit kind, be a little bit forgiving. Right? At the same time, what else is the implication? That all of this represents a world that's not in its perfect state yet. What happens when Mashiach comes? What does that mean? The world is perfect. Guess which attribute will shine, will reign supreme? Gevura. It's going to be perfect. Perfection means an ideal world. This is a good world of Gevura. Guess which opinion, Beit Hillel or Beit Shammai, guess which opinion we're going to be following in the Messianic era? Shammai. Mark, full circle, baby. You ready? Take it away. Text 18. We'll conclude right here.
The opinion of Shammai also has a sword in the spiritual world. Though the halakha does not currently follow his opinion, at a future time it will. When Mashiach comes, the halakha will follow the school of Shammai.
It's symbolic of a greater truth. What does it mean? Shammai embodies Rabbi Eliezer, the same left side, the same Gvura track. It's that intensity, that idealism, that unyielding, that passion, that it perfection. Holding oneself and others to a perfect standard. From a good place, but perfection. That's the world of Mashiach. And so it's fitting that in the world of Mashiach, in a world that's not perfect, so the world, we need Hillels, we need Rabbi Yeshua, that's what we need. In a perfect world, Shammai, it's all about Shammai and Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Eliezer too will find his redemption, please God, at that time. Does it make sense? The takeaway, the practical takeaway is what we said before. Remember, a healthy, a well-balanced person, you know what they say, What's a well-balanced Jew? Someone who has a chip on both of his shoulders or her shoulders. No, but seriously speaking, to be well-balanced means that you have both Chesed and Gvura. But if need be, lean a little bit more to the right side, a little more Chesed. Hope this made sense. Thanks for coming. Oh, some important announcements. Very important announcements. Number one, JLI Barbecue this Sunday. Everyone is invited. Some of you have already responded, either yes or no. If you can make it, everyone is invited. You are personally invited to join us 5 p.m. this Sunday. We've got a great spread, whether you eat meat or don't eat meat. We've got a great spread. Salads and sides and Leah's going to be involved with the cooking, so it's going to be good stuff. And plus a barbecue. So everyone's invited with their families and friends, etc. Sunday at 5, just email me the number of participants, and we'll make sure to have enough food. Also, this Thursday night, we're beginning a brand new course called The Story of Your Life, or The Story of Life in 12 Short Chapters, with Rabbi Zalman Lipsker at 8 p.m. this Thursday night. Everyone is encouraged to participate, or everyone's welcome to participate and encouraged as well. If you would like to sign up, you could just write your name at the entrance in one of their sheets and just check the box that says Story of Life in 12 Short Chapters for that course. And finally, my final announcement is that a week from Sunday, June 9th, we're having a leadership forum, day of leadership classes. We're going to have a morning session and an evening session. Everyone's invited free of charge to join both or one or the other. Begins at 9:30 a.m., and it goes till about 12:30 with breakfast and brunch included. Again, there's no charge. Come and enjoy various classes. You can find their flyers in the front. You can see the schedule of talks and learning opportunities. And then in the evening, I think about 6, we're picking up again with a dinner and some more lectures and talks and schmoozes. Kabbalah and Coffee is on. I will be giving a special Kabbalah and Coffee class on the art of leadership. Yeah. Barbecue is 5. So we should be done. We should. Unless it's a heavy Kabbalah and Coffee. And then no promises. I'm not making any guarantees. Tanya is on. Oh, yeah. Tanya's on Thursday. We're going to be simultaneous. We'll be simulcasting. All right, good stuff. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Hope you enjoyed as much as I did.